Tonight's episode of Shockwaves is brought to you by Fright Rags. Fright Rags is the number one source for horror t-shirts. With specially curated collections curated by Rione horror artists, they offer the best art and the best quality anywhere. New this week at Fright Rags, fresh from Midsummer Scream Convention, they have the new Slashback Video VHS tribute shirt, the amazing new Jaws collection featuring a wonderful assortment of shirts, the brand new They Live line featuring multiple shirts and awesome enamel pins, and they've also just added the Garbage Pail Kids horror movie crossover line. Head over to www.fright-rags.com now and enter the code SUMMERSHOCK10 to get 10% off your entire order. Again, that's SUMMERSHOCK10. Head over to www.fright-rags.com now. Fangoria is back. Resurrected just in time for this Halloween, the magazine that set the standard is coming back as a deluxe 100-page quarterly edition. You'll see some familiar names like Michael Gingold and Tony Timpone, and you'll see bylines that will leave your jaw on the floor. Set visits, deep dives, new discoveries, fiction, and exclusive artwork. Specific contents are being kept under wraps for now because Fangoria wants you to experience true analog nostalgia when you open that black poly bag and see what's inside for the very first time. But it's not just a magazine anymore. Fangoria is also bringing you novels under its Fangoria Presents label, and Fango is also getting into the movie biz. Fangoria will be bringing you some amazing gnarly horror movies starting this August with Puppet Master The Littlest Reich. Head to Fangoria.com and subscribe to Fangoria. New issues drop in October, January, April, and July. A subscription is $60 and will save you about $20 off the cover price. That's Fangoria.com. Subscribe now.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to a very special recording of Blumhouse Productions' Shockwave Podcast.
Thank you guys so much for coming today. Shockwaves live at Midsummer Scream. This is awesome.
Yeah, you never get the full co-hosts when we do live shows. Something happens. One of us starts to die somehow. Today it was Slashback Video downstairs. If you guys haven't seen it, it's amazing. Ryan's worried because there aren't a lot of bodies there, and they're right in the middle of a bar. So he got a little worried that things might start going missing. So he's staying there. We've added Dave Parker, who we should have had on our trivia episode because he is an absolute trivia beast.
He would have just schooled everybody, though. Yeah, total trivia beast.
Yeah, it was a little embarrassing listening to that show.
I know. We'll get you on the next one. You would have answered every question.
How many ghosts in the Haunted Mansion? 10?
How many? 10? I know. Is that not ridiculous? They literally say it as soon as you start on the ride.
But for context, if you don't know, Dave Parker directed The Hills Run Red and Sweet Tooth, which is part of Tales of Halloween. My favorite part of that anthology I really love and want to see a feature made out of. So hopefully, you know, this will inspire everyone, you being on our show.
Get the fuck on that.
I'm working.
And then we're also bringing up another guest co-host. Since we can't have Ryan Turek, we're going to bring up one of our other favorite Ryans in the world. Ryan Larson, please come join us on stage. So Ryan Larson, I feel like I stalk because I know him from the internet. Like, I follow you on everything.
This is how our show works.
I know. I know everything about you, but I think we've met twice.
Yeah, I stalked you at Disneyland.
I know. It was awesome, though.
Yeah, I saw Becca on Instagram at Disneyland, and I told my wife, I was like, I don't care about our vacation. I'm meeting Rebecca McKendry because I need to.
It was awesome. Yes. I was coming off the Jungle Cruise, and you ran up, and I was like, oh, he thinks I'm somebody else.
Yeah. I was just talking to my friends earlier. I was like, it's always nice because you go up, and you're like, I'm Ryan Larson. They're like, hi. And then you remind them who you are. You're like, no, I run the Shockwaves group. And they're like, oh, that Ryan Larson. Got it.
So in addition to the Shockwaves Facebook page, which you guys should all be following by now, we also have our Shockwaves fan page, which is this massive listener group of literally thousands of people who have these amazing discussions about a lot of the stuff that we talk about on the show. And it goes everywhere else. And Ryan runs that. Yeah.
Yeah.
And
thank you. Like 2 years ago now, I was listening to the podcast and Elric talked about this movie called The Fitz. And I was like, I need to talk about this movie with someone. And no one else had seen it. Like, my group of friends was like, what the hell are you talking about? So I was like, listen, I messaged like Rob and I was like, I'm going to make this group. It's going to be a fan club. You don't have to endorse it. I'm just letting you know. And like 8 people joined. And then Rob brought it up on the podcast one day, and there was like, and everyone, now it's 6,000 people. And BJ helped run it, and Dick and Ian. So it's super, super fun. Come over. We keep it. It's all positive vibes no matter what. We keep things just like our
same theory of the
hosts.
Show.
Yeah, exactly. Keep it. So we just keep things fun and try to keep it happy.
And it led to a website.
Yeah, it led to a website as well.
Yes, so that's what I'm repping today is I have my own website called ghastlygrinning.com, which I created because I got really tired of negativity online, and I really wanted to promote celebrating the genre that we all love. So there were so many websites out there, I'm not going to mention names, but that were just like, oh, this is what's wrong with this franchise, or like 10 things that sucked about this trailer. And I was like, no, we love this. Let's celebrate this. So I created Ghastly Grinning with some members I found in the Shockwaves Horror Movie Club. And yeah, so we've been up for like 7 months now, and it's just all about promoting. I mean, literally our slogan is making horror happy, and it's all about like creating a safe space for horror fans where, you know, pretty progressive. So like we just talk about that on the site and just really celebrate the genre.
I still feel bad how mean I was about Microwave Massacre. One time I said something mean about a film and I still feel, I wake up and
I still feel bad that, you know, you guys praised Blood Hook so much.
Which one?
Blood Hook.
Blood Hook.
Blood Hook got a lot of love.
It's not my fault.
It got a lot of love. No, and what's weird is literally after you said something about Microwave Massacre when we went to a break, Rob was like, you were really harsh on Microwave Massacre.
It's really quite terrible. But the cool thing about even the movie you hate most is like somebody loves it.
Someone
like there's
out
somebody
there
out there that
it.
They have a poster above their bed. They make love to their wife under a Microwave Massacre poster. And it's like good for them. Just not for me.
Do we have diehard Microwave Massacre
Anyone?
Fans in the house? There should be at least
Guess
one.
I was wrong.
We got a
no
woo.
One makes love to their
I'll
wife.
Take it. We got a woo.
We're forgetting one person.
Yes, we're forgetting the
key.
The key up here. So Tom Holland is joining us today.
Woo!
Yeah!
And do we need one more microphone? Can we get one more microphone? We seem to be a mic. We only have 4. Okay, we can rotate. That's fine. So Tom is joining us today. We're going to be, in addition to talking about the fact that he's like fucking Tom Holland, we're also going to be talking about our favorite vampire movie. So Tom, welcome. You said you'd never done Midsommar before. Has it been awesome so far today?
I can't believe it. I can't believe Long Beach. Yeah. I mean, you know, I shot down here, but like 15 years ago.
It's like gorgeous now, isn't it?
Unbelievable.
Yeah, this whole area has been like completely reformed. And this convention, this is my 3rd year doing it, and it keeps growing and getting bigger and just becoming massive. And they have like entire haunted houses set up downstairs, and it's amazing. So we're just excited to be back.
We're going to put you on the spot at the start of this, Tom, because we're going to talk about movies, and we're going to just, if you can't remember the title, you give us a weird description.
I can't remember anything anymore.
You just roll with it as much as you can. So we're trying to come up with a topic for the start before we just get into kind of an interview, and because it's midsummer and there's a lot of sunlight, we thought let's reverse that and talk vampire movies, you know, obviously inspired by one of the best vampire movies, Fright Night, which we'll get to. Unfortunately, I might also be saying nice things about Fright Night 2, so brace yourself. You might want to hurt me. I apologize in advance. I can't help it. So we're going with talk about a few vampire films that we think are worth bringing to people's attention. If we forget something that you love, just, you know, shout it out at us and let it roll. What, you want to get us started?
Mine are all deep cuts that people
That's
are going to be like, what?
Deep
it up. Okay, I'll go deep cut. Because I had to stay on brand. So I'm going to start with my absolute favorite vampire movie, which isn't that much of a deep cut, but Larry Fessenden's Habit from 1995 is by far my fave vampire
Top
film.
Top on my list, too.
Are you serious?
Yep.
Why are you aping on my shit, Kane?
It's just a great movie.
Don't do that.
Larry Fessenden's great.
No, it is. It's just a great movie, and I love it because it's a vampire movie. Like, it's a questionable vampire movie, and it kind of reminds me a lot of the second film on my list, which is Martin. We're both of them kind of...
And that was my top 2 choices. I don't even know why I sit next to you.
I don't get it. Stop that.
I'm out.
No, I absolutely love both of them because it kind of looks at vampirism as much as like a mental illness, as much as kind of self-understanding and self-identity. And it gets a lot into kind of the mentality of understanding yourself as different and apart from everyone else. And I think that they both also explore elements of humanity and what it means to be human and what it means to love somebody, too. So.
PhD.
Yeah.
He has a PhD.
I just think you had a crush on Martin.
Yeah, Martin,
when
yeah.
you were younger, and like yeah. he would be at this convention.
Amplis so. Is really hot in that movie. He is.
I think it's because at a certain point, I think of all the, like, I don't know about you guys, but the only monster that scared me when I was a kid was the idea of vampires, nothing else. I never once had a nightmare about werewolves or anything.
Are you serious?
Yeah, it's true. Oh, he's here. Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
In classic Turk style, I can't stay.
Mike Turk.
I gotta go back down.
You're gonna have to pull a chair from the audience up.
No. I just wanted to come up. I have to do...
Mel's on it.
Oh, right on. There's another Ryan here.
I brought in substitute Ryan.
Everybody's got... if you guys haven't been down there, Slashback Video is going on downstairs.
Plugged it.
Oh, you did?
The bar is open.
I don't think we need another
chair. It is incredibly overwhelming.
I think he's totally leaving us.
It's incredibly overwhelming, and I didn't expect it to involve as much manpower as it does, so I need to be down there.
Name one vampire film right now.
Best vampire film. Well, it can't be Habit or Martin, because I just named those two.
Fright Night, because we already know you.
Yeah, and Fright Night.
Hi, Tom. Bram Stoker's Dracula. Bye.
Yeah, okay.
That was Ryan.
Took your third one, didn't he?
Yeah, that was
always ruining my thoughts in mid-sentence. I think what I was saying, when I was a kid, that was the only thing that scared me, so I had to sleep with my covers above my neck till I was like, I don't know, 23. And, you know, once you grow out of that, but as an adult, I can't think of anything less scary to me than vampires. They are, as an adult, they seem so refined. They're not really there to hack you up. They're just kind of slowly draining your life. So I think it's a lot harder. So I think a lot of the tropes, by the time you got to the 70s, the movies worked with Martin and especially Fessenden's Habit, is I think those tropes just played themselves out so much. The only way you could approach a vampire film was to really ground it in realism and to ground it in, is it a vampire? Like, both films play with the idea of we don't even actually know if they are vampires in these two movies.
Right.
And I think that is one way to just kind of make it more of a realistic notion, which could potentially make it scary. Because the idea of the slick-haired vampire just at a certain point, it kind of lost its power, probably after maybe, what was it? Not Frank Langella, he's a good Dracula. There's one, Jack Palance or something. You know, there's just some of them that just become so campy. George, who was the guy?
Hamilton.
Yeah, that was like...
Love at First Bite.
Yeah, Love at First Bite. Yeah. Like, once it becomes a joke, it's really hard to reclaim a character, I think. It takes maybe another 15, 20 years.
Parody and farce was the last gasp of a genre.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That tells you the genre is getting exhausted.
Yeah, that's so true, yeah.
What about you, Dave?
Look at Child's Play.
Yeah, it's true. What?
I mean, again.
The claws came out there, Tom. I like it.
Somebody's going to read a news article now about you getting mad.
Tom, what do you mean? I don't even. What are you implying? Something wrong? No? Okay. Chucky's a vampire?
That's a funny idea.
That has not been done. Parker, what you got?
One of my favorites, and it was probably like one of the first vampire movies that ever really like terrified me as a kid, because I never found vampires that scary. I actually find the idea of it kind of appealing. Mm. Maybe not the killing innocent people and drinking their blood all the time, but I could get behind the living forever thing until I got bored and walked out in the sun. But
I gotta agree with that, because whereas things like Freddy scared me, or you know, shark in my pool scared me, I wanted to be a vampire, so it was like a completely different fascination I had with them. So yeah,
creeps.
What?
Both of you.
Yeah.
Creeps.
Yeah. Of course.
Continue.
But probably my top favorite vampire film is Tobe Hooper's Salem's Lot. Mm-hmm. Single scariest moment of everyone knows it, the kid at the window. And it was like, as seeing it as a kid, I had nightmares forever.
Well, the actual key vampire in it is, I think, the scariest design. I think it's scarier than Nosferatu, even though it basically is coming from Nosferatu. You know, maybe it's the color, the draining of the...
Well, the other thing is he was vicious. He moved. Yeah. He was an animal. He was not, you know, even Nosferatu moved really slow. And this thing is like... smashing through windows and breaking people's necks and everything too. It was terrifying.
Yeah.
Yeah. There was always the charming vampire. And those are the ones that I remember from my childhood. Like Martin was kind of charming, or like Fright Night. That was a very charming vampire for the most part. Like Lost Boys, there was a charm to them, and then they would turn animalistic. But then there were the ones that were just like straight animal.
Right. Monsters. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what I liked. Yeah, of course. See, most of the time the vampire is that sort of, you know, figure of desire. Or what they have and everything. And there's the sexualized version. There's nothing sexually about that Mr. Barlow.
Completely.
And credit to Hooper, who changed it totally from the book. because from Salem's Lot. Mm-hmm. The book is totally different with Barlow. He's not a Nosferatu.
Is he more charming?
Yes.
Or,
yeah.
So. Or James Mason.
James Mason.
James Mason, always charming.
So what do you have on your list that isn't stolen from my list?
Well, yeah, Martin was right up there. I'll just briefly remind, because I think those two films pair very well with one that just came out again, The Addiction by Abel Ferreira, because I think the three are, again, they have a lot in common, but I don't want that to be my pick. This is me cheating. I actually want to talk about the newest one that, is rightfully a classic already, but I think it's the most interesting story almost of any vampire film, and that's Let the Right One In. I think for a contemporary horror film, it's like instantly lands and you feel like you're watching a classically constructed horror tale. And the twist, sorry if you haven't seen it, as you learn about the age of this vampire in relation to their handler, I think it's quite a profound movie. And I think it's really hard to come up with these kind of twists on some of these, long-running fables, you know. But fans of that one here? Yeah? A couple fans? The remake's good.
I actually like the remake, too.
Richard Jenkins is...
He's excellent.
Excellent, and arguably is seen better in the remake than in the original, the whole car thing.
I think if it had come out, if there'd been a bigger gap between the two films, it would be better regarded. Mm-hmm. I think in terms of direction, it's kind of perfect, the remake. But I don't usually even talk about new films, but to me, of the last 15, 20 years, that's one of the best films, I think.
Yeah. Ryan, fave vampire film, or one that you just think everybody should check out?
One, thanks for putting me on the spot. And next to Tom Holland. I actually have a weird relationship with vampires because that's the first movie I ever watched that was horror was Dracula, because I was really fascinated with horror. My mom bought me a Dracula versus X-Men comic book, and I was like, what is this? And I fell in love with comic books and horror at the same time. And so I was like, I really want to watch a horror movie, and my mom was kind of old school and was like, no, they're not appropriate. So she took me to the black and white section, like Universal, and was like, you can pick from these. So the first horror movie I ever watched was Dracula. Bela Lugosi's Dracula, and it started my love affair with horror. So I really love vampires, but I agree with Elric. They're not super scary to me. They were always sexy and charming. So two of the ones I love the most are because they remind me so much of the Euro kind of gothic horror. And I love Interview with the Vampire. Mm-hmm. I just rewatched it because they put it up on Netflix, and I forgot how much I enjoyed that movie. And it's just because it's not really a horror movie. It's hey, here's two sexy dudes that are vampires, and three sexy dudes because Antonio Banderas. And it's just
don't leave out the Banderas.
Yeah. And it's just their life as vampires. And then also Jarmusch did Only Lovers Left Alive.
That was my number four.
So that one fascinated me too, because it was this kind of, it still had that gothic Euro horror feel to it, but it was this modern day spin of they're kind of these rock stars, they felt like rock stars.
They had really good hair in that movie.
Yeah, but
really
the,
good
the
hair.
The fun thing that film plays with, and the part that you guys both liked that I don't think I'd like, is the part of living forever. I think that film nails this idea of what the hell do you spend all that time doing? Right. I think I could live a good 150 years, but at a certain point, the essence of life is the fact that it's running out, and that the things you have to rush towards is because you have a finite amount of time. So suddenly you're eternal. It just seems to me you're just going to hang out and listen to records.
But I think Only Lovers Left Alive really addressed that, because it was they were bored.
No, that's what it is. That's the whole point of the movie.
I thought you were overlooking that.
No, that's what I liked about the movie. It felt like it's a hangout movie. It's this is just vampires chilling, you know?
Yeah, we don't have anything else to do.
I don't think there's much bloodlust in it.
But I would say that the forerunner of those movies especially is The Hunger.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, and that shows living for a really long time and not being that bored and having a pretty glamorous life, and you can't get more rock star than Bowie.
That's great.
And visually, that movie, the style, the editing, and everything for the time at that time, it's
really
Tony Scott does not get enough credit for really how well made that movie is. You go, oh, that's where a lot of MTV came from.
Yeah,
from that movie.
One of my favorite soundtracks.
It's an amazing soundtrack.
It's amazing.
So Tom's not going to get off the hook though.
Yeah, Tom.
You
got to pick a vampire film.
In regards to also prepping for Fright Night, what were some of the films that you were inspiring that in terms of, were there any key inspirations vampire-wise?
I was writing Cloak and Dagger.
I love that film.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, some of you may know it, not in rotation that much now. Henry Thomas and
Dabney Coleman.
Dabney Coleman. And it was I was doing a supposedly a a remake of The Window, which is the juvenile version of Rear Window, same writer. And I said, if you really wanted to have a kid see something going on in the house next door and you wanted to update it, he wouldn't be seeing a murder.
Yeah.
He'd be seeing a vampire chomping down on somebody. And everybody thought I was nuts. I mean, literally at Universal. I mean, because at that moment in time, vampires couldn't have been more out.
Yeah, what was the horror climate like at that time? Like, what was really... I don't remember a lot of vampires right then.
There were no horror. There were no. Well, there was the
slashers.
There was a slasher, but even by that time, the slasher had gotten tired. I mean, Friday the 13th. Historically, in that moment, Friday the 13th was a joke. Paramount was ashamed of having to make them, but the audience kept asking for more. So they were a money earner, but nobody mentioned it. You know, I mean it. Horror has always been the redheaded stepchild of Hollywood.
Why you got to bring redheads into it, dude?
Walked right into that one.
Sorry. Horror was in the basement, and vampires weren't even considered because you'd had that huge disaster of the Dracula musical that Robert Wise had directed, and that died a horrible death, and it was a huge Broadway hit.
Go home and Google that one, guys. There's fun stories there.
Yeah, but I mean, it was a huge Broadway hit, but didn't translate to film. And then, as I said, you went into parody, into farce, which was Love at First Bite. And when they start making fun of the genre, or they start winking at the audience, you know, breaking the third wall and saying, well, we're in on the joke too, then the genre really is... And I'd like to think that I came along and accidentally reinvented it.
So what did you have to do to convince them that a vampire was worth investing in again?
I couldn't. Nobody wanted to make it then. So I said, well, screw this. I could not get the story out of my head. And I always had the concept, you know, of a kid seeing a vampire next door. But it was when I thought of Peter Vincent that all of a sudden I couldn't wait to get home and to write it. But I grew up with the Friday Night Frights, which the only place you could find a horror movie on television when I was growing up was Friday night at 11 o'clock on your local channel, because no network would ever put it on. So there was a small group of people that were really, at high school I'm talking about, they were really interested like in the Friday Night Frights, and the three or four of us hung out together. We were also the only ones who were reading EC Comics. You got to remember that Tales of the Crypt, the comics were banished in 1954 or 55. So after that, you could only find a horror comic from, who was it who did that? I can't remember now, the company. But anyway, because
EC?
EC, but EC did four or five. It wasn't only Tales of the Crypt.
They had the vaults.
There was the witch. There was the yeah, and but there was a small group of us kids, all boys, who sort of passed around these banned comics. So outside of that, the high end horror product was Hammer and AIP. And for those of you who have seen them or who might faintly remember, they were highly saturated. They were very, very colorful, deep colors. They were shot like television in 1954. It was a wide shot, I don't even know if they hardly ever did inserts because they had these beautiful sets set up in England, so they shot the sets.
Very lavish and surprisingly bloody, but no one really paid attention because they look like Shakespearean, like just so splendorous. It was very elaborate and elegant.
Yeah, and then Christopher Lee. I actually ended up having lunch with Christopher Lee.
Oh, my.
Yeah,
I want to hear this.
Just when he had gotten or when he had finished shooting Lord of the Rings. And, I mean, he was charming, he was wonderful, blah, 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 and he was so full of himself. I mean, Christopher Lee could have played Peter Vincent.
You know?
I don't think he would have been amused if I'd suggested it, though. But anyway, so That was my frame of reference, like the films they're talking about up here now are your frame of reference when you're growing up. And so Fright Night was my love letter to what it had been for me and for my group growing up, which would have been all just prior to 1960 and just after 1960.
Yeah, and you got to do that great little homage to Hammer in the movie.
Yeah, I did. So what happened was then I had the original script and I went around with the original script, but by then I was so hot as a writer that I was able to pull it off. What's the truth? I always ask myself, what's the truth of these stories? Okay. But it wouldn't interest you, but Guy McElwain was head of Columbia. And they brought me in, and Guy didn't know who I was, and then Guy saw me, and he remembered me from, I met him socially. I wish the hell I'd thought I'd gone through these names. Pamela Mason. Pamela Mason was a great Hollywood, she had a salon. I forget whether it was Saturdays or Sundays, but anybody who was anybody in Hollywood would show up at the salons. And they were all these famous people. And this girl I knew, who's no longer with us, girl at the time, would take me. And I didn't know, I was so intimidated by all the famous people that I didn't know what to say. And Guy would always look at me and say, he's the kid who doesn't say anything. And there I was, I don't know how many years later, 4 or 5 years later, in there saying, well, do you want to make my movie? And I think because he recognized me from those years before at the Hollywood gathering, that's why he said, yeah, go ahead. He figured probably that I was one of the in crowd, which certainly wasn't true. But anyway, he gave the go ahead, and it was a throwaway. It was an empty slot, the only empty slot that Columbia had on their release that day. And their big movie was, which they thought was going to be make a gazillion dollars, was Perfect. Does anybody remember Perfect?
John Travolta's thrusting.
John Travolta.
Jamie Lee
John
Curtis.
As an aerobics.
What, Jamie Lee?
Yeah, and John Travolta's a Rolling
that.
Stone reporter, right?
Yeah, you'll find that on GIF.
Yeah, the two
everywhere.
It's just John Travolta thrusting.
The two hottest stars of the time. And I'm amazed that I'm here. I'm amazed that you're here. Because, you know, what's happened is that the genre itself has just become huge and increasingly more important. Horror has always been the least expensive to produce, i.e. cheapest, and it's also been the most consistently remunerative of the genres, which means the most dependable. And Fright Night was a success. But what happened, unlike most movies, it didn't go away. Fright Night kept growing, and it became inter- or multi-generational. Mm-hmm. Parents showed it to their kids, grandparents showed it to their grandchildren, and it never occurred to me, but I mean, Fright Night's bigger now than when it was released in 84 or 85. And I thank you all for that.
I see, obviously, Rear Window is a big influence just on the story, but how big an influence was Hitchcock to you in general as you made that transition into directing, obviously with your work on the script for Psycho 2, but how much did his work mean to you?
Everything. I mean, literally everything. Look at Child's Play. Child's Play I set out to make a killer doll movie. I set out to make a movie about a doll that scared the shit out of you, okay? And then I put a few laughs in to release it along the way, the tension. But if anybody remembers, somebody said, what's suspense to Hitchcock? And Hitchcock said, well, you know, the audience sees somebody place a stick of dynamite beneath the kitchen table, he runs out, and then the people come in to have dinner. And the audience knows there's dynamite underneath the table, but nobody else does. That's suspense. Okay, the opening of Child's Play, you see the maniacal serial killer put himself into the doll. Nobody else knows it. And nobody sure as hell is ever going to believe it. So when you see mom get that doll and give it to Andy, her son, you know they don't. That's suspense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, that's good.
You're going to school.
Yeah. That's how you do it.
I always feel like I...
You've earned this, so you just go for it.
You go.
Yeah, but I mean, this should be very... You guys are charming. And you're wonderful, and you're more knowledgeable than I am. But I think I tend to be more like the guy who's teaching a film class. And I don't mean to do that to you, but, you know, that's the mechanics, the pieces that are put together to make it work that you love so much. Somebody knew what the hell they were doing. And they were going for something specific with you, you know, mm-hmm. to take you along for the ride. Well, and that has been for good or bad, because I failed as much as I've succeeded, God knows. You know,
that's the industry.
But that's the intent behind a lot of what I've done.
Now, going back I'm sticking with you for once. Ryan, you're coming back, man. You're coming back.
You can borrow mine.
But bringing it back to vampires, we were talking about, you know, how to decide whether it's more of a charming vampire or kind of a more animalistic, feral vampire, and kind of the cross in between. Like, how did you decide what to do with Jerry?
Because in order for you, the audience, to be involved, you have to care about the people that are in the story. And that means that they have to have a certain life, a certain reality, and they have to be likable. I know that's a horrible word to use today, but if you're going to identify and go along for the ride, you know. Yet, well, I mean, Chucky's attacking a single mother and a seven-year-old boy, yeah. And you saw how he started out, and you know he's the Lakeside Strangler. I mean, you're worried for the mother and the little boy, and you like them. They're decent people. They're your next door neighbors, you know that, and that is all deliberate. Doesn't mean it works, but. It's deliberate. So if you get involved with the people in the movie and what they're struggling to do or the danger that they're trying to avoid, then you identify with them and you'll be there for the ride to see how it comes out. And that's terrific when you can pull it off.
Well, and think about Norman, right, from Psycho. You're describing that exact setup.
That's a whole other thing. Yeah. Hitchcock was everything to me because I wrote Psycho, too. I wrote it when nobody else would, because everybody else considered it, you know, certain death. And much to everybody's amazement, including my own, it turned out to be just a terrific movie.
Yeah, it's a great film, yeah.
Yeah, but, I mean, I didn't, you know... I mean, every one of these, you go in, you need magic. You know, everybody, you can listen to the directors and the writers that'll come through here, and they'll all pretend like they have a secret to it or there's something they do. You need a little bit of luck. You need the actors to like each other for one. You know, so it's magic dust that's put down that makes them really work when it happens.
I've heard that it was Scream for Help that made you. That's the reaction most people have. Scream to Help, but I think it's a lot of fun. But I've heard that it was seeing that made you decide to you wanted to give directing a shot to be in control of your work. Is that?
Yeah. They made a movie called The Scream for Help, which from original script of mine, and I swear to you, the script was good, and the movie's absolutely the abysmal.
Okay. It's up for debate.
And it was. It was Michael Winner,
yeah.
who after Charles Bronson, Death Wish, was like the hottest director in Hollywood, and he had trouble with Juan Tan Tan, the magic dog. He did a Rin Tin Tin movie.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and that wrecked him. And out of desperation, he took Scream for Help, and he didn't have a clue. But he was a very, very, very nice man, Michael Winner, and he did the Charles Bronson movies.
Yeah, I just want to say what
when we're talking about different vampires and stuff, what I always loved about Fright Night is you had the best of both worlds.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, that thing became, you know, Jerry Dandridge became a beast, a monster, and everything else. So that's what I always liked about that. I'm curious, though, was there ever a time where they, because it was so effects heavy at the time and that wasn't being done by the studio system that much, did they ever try to suggest to you, like, go, well, maybe you don't tell that Jerry's a vampire for a while and try to hold it back more, or did they just go for it?
No, I didn't have any. The only note that I had was the original ending of the movie. I had written Peter Vincent on TV as Amy and Charlie watched him from their bedroom. He says, I want to thank you, Charlie. And as he talks, Peter Vincent starts to turn into a vampire. Mm. Ooh.
Plot twist.
And the studio said to me, you can't do that. You can't have a down ending. You can't have an ending where, you know, where one of your lead characters loses. You know, actually, they should talk to Stephen King. But I mean, you know, so I changed, and I didn't do that, and I had a happy ending. I did not feel it was I did not feel they were doing a terrible thing. I mean, I understood why they felt that way.
There's really, I mean, there's only, in my opinion, there's only a handful of horror comedies that truly work. And that tonal balance is really, you know, your film, Evil Dead 2. A lot of people love horror comedies, but often I think what they're watching are like comedy films with some horror elements, but not really horror. Your film actually scares when it needs to, but it's so charming and funny. How tough a tightrope as a, you know, early director was that balance, and how concerned are you when you're making a film like that it's going to land? Or am I just going to stress you out thinking about that?
It was my first directorial effort. I was just thrilled that I was doing it. Yeah. And if it had crashed and burned and I'd never done anything else, at least I would have directed one Hollywood film.
Yeah.
Which at that moment in time was like my life. You know, I survived Psycho 2. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I think Psycho 2 is a brilliant movie, by the way. Yeah. I think it's a hell of a movie, and it's the last time that group was together. That was the last breath of those people who'd worked with Hitchcock. I've met so many people, and one of the greatest mistakes of my life was I didn't have an autograph book. Mm. I should have gotten autographs.
Well, the director of that was obsessed with Hitchcock's work, right? Franklin. He was a huge
Richard Franklin. He was an Aussie.
Yeah.
You're New Zealander?
Yep, Kiwi.
The Kiwi, yeah, Richard, at that moment in time, everybody was coming out of USC. Uh-huh. I mean,
woo!
That.
I teach there. Go.
That's
fight
all
on.
The show is going to degrade into now.
Yeah, but that's the Spielberg generation. Yeah. That's Randall Kleiser. That's everybody was coming out then. Then I think at that moment in time, UCLA was known for screenwriters, mm-hmm. and USC was known for people who actually could do it.
I like to think that's still the case.
Richard had Hitchcock down to USC, and they were all confounded because they hadn't started having panels yet where they would have the filmmakers and the directors. It was like they'd never done it and nobody knew. And it was still like that in 1982 because I went down to USC and did one of the panels. And that was when... It was just when every college was having a film department. And 4 or 5 years previously, you couldn't find one. I went to Northwestern, to the theater school, because I couldn't get into a film school because there were no film schools. I don't want to tell you the year. But anyway... But I mean, so that's how much has changed.
Did that actually help you? Did that working with actors feel much more natural because of that degree?
No.
Okay. Scratch.
What did make a difference was that Richard took me through like a graduate seminar in Hitchcock. Mm. And that's because we ran every film, including The Silence, that Hitchcock had made, and we would schedule them to be screened at Universal. Because you couldn't... This is just... When cable is coming in, I can't remember whether VHS was in, whether DVD, whether the boxes were in yet or not.
And Hitchcock had like a bungalow at Universal. At
Hitchcock
the time, right?
Had the whole side, which is now a big building. They were all bungalows. And Hitchcock had a bungalow. And I got all these stories because everybody who worked on Psycho 2, the old gang, or what was left of it, was brought back. Hilton Green, who produced it, was the first AD on Psycho. And so I heard all the stories, good, bad, happy, and sad. You know, I mean, the script supervisor had worked for Hitchcock. I mean, you know, Loomis.
Yep, Sam Loomis.
What's her name? This is a Parker question.
Huh?
Sam Loomis. Oh.
She's still alive. She's down in Palm Springs. Vera Miles.
Oh, there we go.
Yeah, Vera Miles, who had...
Trivia beast.
Told you.
Well, Vera Miles was supposed to have been the blonde in Vertigo.
Trivia beast.
Yeah. You know, and she was pregnant. And so Hitchcock gave it...
Twins.
Yeah.
He's not that good.
But Hitchcock gave the part to...
Janet Leigh.
Kim Novak.
No.
Kim Novak. No, wait. No.
Vertigo. Well,
Vertigo? Kim Novak of Vertigo.
That's right, yeah.
Parker. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Don't test me on Vertigo. I've got Vertigo down.
And Vera Miles was forever crushed because she missed her moment. But Vera Miles was also infinitely smarter than the gal who played... I shouldn't say this. But, you know,
Kim Novak?
It would have been a much... Vertigo would have been much different if Vera Miles had played the lead. And she was a terrific actress. Not a warm, fuzzy person, but a terrific actress.
Well, since Rob Galuza is not here to, like, call us to task, I'm going to pull us back because we're pushing the clock here, guys. So we're going to throw out a couple more vampire titles, and I want to make sure we have some time at the end to take questions from the audience because that's, like, the best part of doing these things at conventions. So let's do a couple more vampire titles. Again, all minor deep cuts. So what else you got?
You know, one that I just started really digging just last year again was the Stephen King Night Flyer. I got to say, that was one that was never really on my radar when I was young.
Scariest vampire, dude. The teeth in that, one tooth in the middle. I don't know how he actually bites or chews, but amazing.
It actually feels like it is copying from Fright Night's model a lot because it's kind of like a comical idea. There's a serial killer who's flying a plane, like a small single passenger plane into places and, you know, draining people's blood, but then once you see the reveal, it's such a grotesque vampire, and then there's these incredible sequences that look like they're shot in like black and white Fulci hell, which are very... The drama of the film hasn't aged as well. It's got a bit of a 90s vibe to Miguel Ferrer stuff, but that was a film that, just seeing it about a year ago when we were having the director on the show, we weren't there, but Rob did. I was kind of struck by how strong it still was and how kind of grotesque the creature was.
It has a real noir vibe to it, which I always liked, where it's like the reporter on the case trying to investigate, and it had this real great noir.
Yeah, I thought it was cool.
There's a charm to it. It's just, you know, but you know, I get it's unfortunate that it's really hard to find.
It's like only an out of print DVD for like $60 or something. It's bound to eventually come out, you know.
Yeah, sure. We'll poke some people about a Blu-ray for that. On the noir vibe, I'm also going to throw out, because this is vampires as if told through a noirish story, at least plot-wise, and then channeled through South Korea, 2009's Thirst.
Oh, yeah. I like this a lot.
I absolutely love that movie so much. Chan-Wook Park doing that.
It's a priest.
Yeah, a priest
that's a vampire. What a great crossover. You know?
Yeah, who he's trying to do this very altruistic drug story. Trial to stop this disease that's ravaging everybody. And through that, he ends up getting the disease and then has to have a blood transfusion. And through the blood transfusion, he gets vampirism. And then kind
of... Science.
Yeah, science. There's science. Some shit happens in science and he gets vampirism. But then that kind of opens up animalistic behavior. And whereas he was already questioning his role as a priest moralistically, that becomes more prolific. And then he realizes he's attracted to like his best friend's wife at that point.
Yeah, most movies with priests having sex end poorly. But this one's actually quite good.
It's beautiful.
It's actually quite saucy, but usually
it
goes the other way.
I cried at the end of this movie. What are you talking about?
That's what I'm saying. It's not spotlightish. The spotlight's bad, Priest.
Oh,
this
okay.
is like good Priest.
This is, it's still sad.
You have to fall somewhere on the spectrum.
But it's kind of beautiful. It's
beautiful.
Yeah,
I think it's a great film.
So, yeah, that's
I'm agreeing with you. She can't take it when I agree
with
her.
I can't. I don't
She's
know
just
how to
like
handle this outright.
Hesitant and worried.
Tell me I'm wrong, and I will argue.
You are correct.
That's what we do. So, yeah, Parker.
All right. Just going through... I mean, I had so many. A real interesting one that maybe, I don't know how many people have seen. It's called Shadow of the Vampire.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Why couldn't have you killed the script girl?
Yeah, it's Malkovich and William Dafoe, yeah. And it's about the fictional making of Nosferatu. And
that film's not as big as it should be. That should be almost as big as Ed Wood, in my opinion, for horror fans.
That's why I just think, there's, you know, I've got a ton of them, but, you know, I just think that one hasn't been... You know, seen a lot.
Making a movie?
Yeah.
They're making Nosferatu.
So it's about the making of Murnau's.
That's a terrific idea.
Yeah.
The idea comes from, like, this, it's kind of folklorish, but there's a photo of Max Schreck wearing the makeup, you know, 100 years ago when they made Nosferatu. And, you know, no one was doing makeup at that point that looked like that. And his last name in German meant death, and no one knew where he came from. I mean, I'm sure the director did, but, you know, in popular culture. So people started actually speculating, what if this was a vampire that was used because he looked so ungodly. He looked like a weird rat thing.
And the movie got shut down very, very quickly after its release in Germany. It got actually sued by Bram Stoker's widow, and they destroyed all of the prints. And so it was just kind of like...
Of the original Nosferatu.
A couple made it overseas to America, and a few made it to Britain, where Dracula, the original Bram Stoker story, was no longer in public domain, so they were able to start screening them. And it was actually the success of Nosferatu's kind of bootleggy screenings here that led to Universal to make Dracula because they realized that it was really popular.
So the film he's talking about ends up basically John Malkovich plays Murnau the director, and he knows that the guy he has got is a real vampire, and he's like, it's worth the risk. So he starts shooting the movie, and slowly he starts knocking off everyone on the production, and that's why he just has a great line where I think he kills the cameraman. He's like, why couldn't you have killed the script girl?
I'll eat her later.
It's one of the best performances, period, by Willem Dafoe. Just next level.
I think the movie is proof too. If you don't have a big budget, just hire Willem Dafoe to play the monster because he already looks like one. So you're
he
good
can
to go.
Yeah he can deliver yeah
he's terrifying. Yeah. I'll jump in real quick with one. I think I'd be remiss if I didn't at least mention Blade. I think it gets passed over a little.
Blade
much.
One, not two.
Blade one and two.
Yes,
and
two,
then
two rules.
Three in a weird.
No,
three in a weird. I'm a
masochistic sort of
way. Three in a weird. I'm a wrestling fan, so I wanted to see Triple H as a vampire way. But that's it. Just that. But Blade One, because I love Blade One, and it's actually pretty faithful to the source material. And then Guillermo, of course, came around with Blade Two and was like, "I'm just gonna like mind fuck all of you guys with these vampires." And it's I love both those movies. So,
I'm going to call out a couple of deep cuts real quick. Okay. So The Insatiable from 2006. I've talked about this one on the podcast before, and none of y'all fuckers have watched it.
No,
because that's what they do. So 2006, The Insatiable. It's Sean Patrick Flannery. Real tiny movie about this guy, real down on his luck, really hates his life, is wandering through the streets of his city one night coming home from work and sees a vampire, this gorgeous female vampire, attacking a guy in an alley. And he becomes obsessed with her to the point that he constructs a cage in his basement and tries to catch her. And he does. And he puts her in the cage. And then most of the movie is him falling in love with her while she's in the cage, her potentially falling in love with him back, but he's always questioning, is she just doing this so that I'll let her out of the cage and she can eat me? And so it's real small, and the majority of it happens in that room, but it's really good. So that's The Insatiable from 2006. I'll also say Midnight Sun from 2012.
I've got that one on my list.
Sleeper hit.
I think this film just got zero play. I remember seeing the first screening of it. Scott Liebrecht is the director, and it's very much in line with Habit and Mardin.
Yeah.
So if you're looking for a more realistic ground, it's shot in L.A. They work at, I think, a blood transfusion place.
Yeah, a guy has a real bad skin disease. He can't go out in the sun, but that's what it's posited as a skin disease. It's really, I liked that one a lot.
Can I ask one question? You're talking, and don't get mad at me, because I promise I don't know anything about this. Were you approached to do a sequel originally to Fright Night? Like, how did And if it's all just bad memories, you can just throw.
That's good enough.
But I don't know. I don't know what happened after the success of Friday Night
Lights. I wasn't available.
Oh. Oh,
I was shooting something else, and I remember what. Oh God, what happened was everybody that had been gotten Fright Night produced to Columbia was subsequently fired once the movie came out and it was a big success. Huh. And the big agent, book agent who really ran Columbia, Ray Stark. Okay, so Ray Stark fired everybody, including Guy McElwain, and he brought in a very, very pretentious Englishman whose name I now forget.
But it wasn't Michael Winner.
No, it wasn't.
Well, let him off this one.
No, Michael Winner was not pretentious.
No,
he
was British.
No, he wasn't. He was, you know, I could go on.
He was charming.
But anyway, he brought in this guy who had produced Roland Joffe's stuff, The Killing Field, the Chariots of Fire. So they
movies.
Were big, prestigious, well, movies that were Academy, you know, Oscar bait and that kind of thing. And the last thing he wanted to do were any more horror movies. Mm. And so what he did is he canceled my overall deal and let me go. And I immediately went and made a deal over at MGM, housekeeping. But that's what happened. Staying alive in Hollywood is a problem. Maybe it's more stable now, but I started out on Child's Play, I started out with one group, and by the time I finished it, I had the fourth administration in there.
Mm-hmm. So you end up having nothing to do with the sequel. They didn't even consult you.
No, what happened is that they were going to do the sequel, Columbia. And then when this Englishman came in, there was no way he was going to make Fright Night 2, even though Fright Night 2 had goddamn been their nearest biggest grosser for that year. Mm. They had made a fortune out of it, specifically in Japan. Mm. But he wasn't about money. He was about, you know, Oscar bait. And so Herb Jaffe got it, and Herb Jaffe went ahead and did the remake. And I don't know. I wasn't there, but I know that they had financial trouble while they were shooting. Mm. And they pulled back on the budget, and then Tommy Lee got stuck with that.
I mean, because Tommy Lee's talent is making something out of nothing, right? For as a production designer and all the different jobs he's worn. That's why I think it still has some great gags. But
I never got a real release on Fright Night.
Still really
still
hard
stuck
to
on VHS.
Hard to get, yeah. Well, let's get to the audience.
We only have 10 minutes left, so let's go ahead and do some audience questions. We can at least do a couple.
Can I move this? Should I be the guy who goes out there and like goes, woo?
You can do
there
it.
There you go. All right.
Do it.
Woo.
Do it.
All right.
I see
Hopefully
one
I won't hurt
over
myself.
There.
All right. Who has a question?
First one, right there.
I don't think I can reach quite that. I know it won't work. I'll translate for you.
Do you have, for Tom, do you have recollections of working with Brad Fidel, the score on
Fright Night's
Fantastic?
Yeah, Brad's wonderful. He's retired. He's not retired, but he's living up in Santa Barbara. Yeah, I hired Brad because it was the second electronic score I think I heard. The first one was Wizard, the Nitroglycerin, the Wages of Fear, the remake of that.
Oh, Sorcerer. Tangerine Dream.
Yeah. And then the second one that I heard electronic was a little movie called Terminator, which Brad Fidel did, and on the strength of the Terminator, I hired him, and I was lucky enough to get him.
All right, next question. No picking your nose after a question asking. Yeah, yeah.
This is for Tom. Personally, what makes a great horror story?
What makes a great horror story?
If I knew, I wouldn't have made some of the movies I did.
All right.
Solid.
Aussie. To the Aussie.
Hi, Aaron.
So I would love to hear from Tom about Stephen King. And I'm also really curious about the script for The Hills Run Red.
It's two different questions.
Yeah, so we got Stephen King from Tom
Typical
Holland
from an Australian to push
Hills,
his luck.
Hills
we'll
Run
start
Red.
With Tom.
What about the script?
I just love it. It's great.
Oh, thanks. I didn't write it. What happened was there was this company out in New York called Media Blasters, and they had this
division, they put out a bunch of Italian stuff, imports and everything else. And then they started making movies. And they were making them on the East Coast. They came out here to the West Coast, met with a couple directors and everything, and I did a presentation on that script, and they said, okay, we're going to go with you to make the movie. I said, great. We want to write it from page one, but we can get you David J. Scow, who wrote The Crow, because he had been friends of mine and the producer, Rob Burnett's, for a lot of years. And we had blackmail material on him. So we got him cheap. And but no, and it was just, you know, I've loved his writing for so long. So to be able to know a writer of that caliber, it was just, and it was fun. He's not, despite writing two Chainsaw movies and stuff, he's not a real big, like, slasher, mass killer kind of guy. That's really more where I came in. So what we would do is, he went off and wrote a draft pretty quickly, and then I would go over to his place, and we'd sit there till like 3 or 4 in the morning just working on it and going, well, how about this? And just talking it. And just,
hey, guys.
The alarm. So that's how it came about. And then we shot this movie that I did in 2009, the slasher movie called The Hills Run Red for Warner Brothers and Dark Castle. We shot in Bulgaria. So then when we were there, they didn't bring David over. So I just did the quick little revisions based on settings and locations and stuff like that. And then in the editing process of the movie, after the head of Warner Premiere saw the movie, then a lot of other things were sort of rewritten because she was completely offended by the movie. So,
I guess this will probably be our last, right? Tom, what are your recollections of working with Stephen King?
Okay, Stephen King. Stephen King, I think, is responsible for a lot of everybody sitting here now. Stephen King took horror, at least literary horror, out of being sort of, a lot of it had been Victorian.
Yeah.
English.
It's like taking it to the suburbs.
Yeah, it went from kind of the gothic-y horror to it happening
being
Maine.
Next door.
Yeah.
Yeah, Shirley Jackson started to open it up. Thinner was on the, I couldn't get Thinner done for 13 years. The reason I couldn't get it done was because it had a downer ending.
Yeah.
I also left the remake of Village of the Damned because they kept insisting on a terrible ending. Anyway, the Stephen, as a human being, is a very nice, decent guy next door. He really is your high school English teacher. I mean that's what he's like. At least that's what he was like for me on Langoliers. A couple of years later, when we did Thinner, something had happened, and I could tell it by the way the crew treated him. He'd gone from being a guy who wrote horror novels to being Stephen King. So at some point, the success, just the pure weight of it, you know, changed how people, you know, treated him. I remember that. I don't know. I stand in awe, not only of his. It's the number. It's how prolific he is. Mm-hmm. So somehow he's been able to keep his head on straight through all of it. I mean, he went through his, you know, he went through his period. He's a devotee of AAA, of Alcoholics Anonymous. But he's.
Well, you've seen Maximum Overdrive.
No, he meant AAA, the car service, since he was hit by the van.
Yeah.
What did you say? Anyway, I mean, some of his work is just, I think, is brilliant. Some, like everybody else's, some's brilliant, some's terrific, some's so-so, some's not good at all. But he keeps on going. I mean, the quintessential story is, you know, he came and he did a part on Langoliers. And he was an absolute nervous wreck. If you're making a movie, they always call you 2 or 3 hours before they're going to need you in case something changes. God forbid, you know, that you look around for the actor and he's not there. So he was a nervous wreck.
because he was away from the word processor. He wasn't writing. I mean, really emotionally upset that he was, and this is in Bangor, for Christ's sake. We're at the Bangor airport, you know, 20 minutes from his house. But he told me he had a whiteboard on the wall, and he had it divided up months in advance. And he was working on two projects at the same time. He'd write one in the morning, and then he'd write one in the afternoon. I don't know how the hell you do that. But I mean, so... So there's something very homey, the guy next door, about him, and yet at the same time, he'd be writing even if he wasn't paid.
Yeah,
he'd be writing even if he could never get anything published. You know, I mean, he'd still be back in Bangor working a laundromat, and his wife being a teacher or whatever, or he'd be the teacher. He was a teacher. He was a high school teacher. English high school teacher, but the compulsion. Now I had dinner with him, but I never got to know him well enough to know what the psychological makeup is. But you know, he's the one that popularized horror. He carried horror to the middle class,
and
he
still
took,
going.
Yeah, he took horror out and made it safe for your mother to read it. You know, but seriously, he did.
Just last night, I watched the first episode of Castle Rock. So now that's his whole universe coming together.
His resurgence has been amazing.
Yeah, we have to wrap. But I want first for you guys to show your appreciation for Tom and his incredible work. And a big thank you to our improv guest who didn't know he was going to be doing this, Ryan Larson.
Thanks, guys.
And one of our favorite humans who's going to come on the full show again, Dave Parker.
This is great.
And also a huge thank you to Midsummer Scream for having us here.
Yeah.
Such an awesome con. So thank you guys so much for coming out. You can find us on socials, under Shockwaves.
And downstairs, right?
And we're downstairs. Go see Slashback.
T-shirts. If you want to buy any Shockwaves t-shirts, we have some down there.
Wait a minute. I want to put a plug in, too. I have a horror site called TH Terror Time. Please take a look at that.
And he's signing.
And I'm signing downstairs at Dark Dell, at you know, with nice. Dell and Sue down there. And we've got the children's books, but we also are just literally coming out with a Child's Play comic book.
Nice. That's
cool.
Yeah. Anybody remember the one back? Remember the Fright Night comic books from around 2000? 90s? Yep. 90s, yeah.
I had those.
They have 22 issues. So we're reviving Fright Night, the comic book.
Awesome.
And a very big thank you to, I know some of you probably have no idea that you just wandered into this room, didn't know what you're coming into. Thank you for staying, and thank you to the listeners who keep us going. There's a reason why we keep doing this show. It's because of your enthusiasm. So thank you. And we'll just hopefully see you guys for some photos or weird face touching or whatever you want to do. All right. Well, see you later.
Just his face.
That's for you, Axel.
Tonight's episode of Shockwaves is brought to you by Fright Rags. Fright Rags is the number one source for horror t-shirts. With specially curated collections curated by Rione horror artists, they offer the best art and the best quality anywhere. New this week at Fright Rags, fresh from Midsummer Scream Convention, they have the new Slashback Video VHS Tribute Shirt. The amazing new Jaws collection featuring a wonderful assortment of shirts. The brand new They Live line featuring multiple shirts and awesome enamel pins. And they've also just added the Garbage Pail Kids horror movie crossover line. Head over to www.fright-rags.com now and enter the code SUMMERSHOCK10 to get 10% off your entire order. Again, that's SUMMERSHOCK10. Head over to www.fright-rags.com now. Fangoria is back. Resurrected just in time for this Halloween, the magazine that set the standard is coming back as a deluxe 100-page quarterly edition. You'll see some familiar names like Michael Gingold and Tony Timpone, and you'll see bylines that will leave your jaw on the floor. Set visits, deep dives, new discoveries, fiction, and exclusive artwork. Specific contents are being kept under wraps for now because Fangoria wants you to experience true analog nostalgia when you open that black poly bag and see what's inside for the very first time. But it's not just a magazine anymore. Fangoria is also bringing you novels under its Fangoria Presents label, and Fango is also getting into the movie biz. Fangoria will be bringing you some amazing gnarly horror movies starting this August with Puppet Master The Littlest Reich. Head to Fangoria.com and subscribe to Fangoria. New issues drop in October, January, April, and July. A subscription is $60 and will save you about $20 off the cover price. That's Fangoria.com. Subscribe now.